Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for March 4th, 2014. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and today I'm talking with Jeffrey Abbott about a potassium channel that cooperates with a transporter to regulate the composition of cerebrospinal fluid. Cerebrospinal fluid bathes the central nervous system, and it provides both physical and chemical support for the brain and spinal cord. It provides physical support by cushioning the brain to protect it from injury, and it also helps support the weight of the brain, which is a very dense organ. Cerebrospinal fluid provides chemical support for the brain by delivering oxygen and nutrients from the blood and taking waste back to the bloodstream. In a study published in this issue of Science Signaling, Jeffrey Abbott's group reports on how a potassium channel helps regulate the composition of cerebrospinal fluid. Abbott spoke to me by telephone from the University of California, Irvine. On the phone with me is Jeffrey Abbott. Welcome, Dr. Abbott.
Thank you, Annalisa. It's very nice to be speaking with you.
This work started with a knockout mouse. You made mice that lacked a gene called KCNE2, which encodes a subunit of a voltage-gated potassium channel. And it's been implicated in seizure disorders and long QT syndrome, which is a type of cardiac arrhythmia. What's the phenotype of the KCNE2 knockout mice? Do they have cardiac arrhythmia or seizures?
Yeah, so the KCNE2 knockout mice have long QT syndrome, so that's the cardiac arrhythmia which humans with KCNE2 mutations also get. And they also have handling-induced seizures, which we have been able to quantify further by giving the mice a chemoconvulsant to bring out more seizures.
Potassium channels are found in most cell types, but they're particularly important in electrically active cells like neurons and cardiac muscle. Can the phenotypes that you observed in the knockout mice be attributed to defects in the electrical activity of those cell types?
So the answer to that one is yes and no. We have studied KCNE2 knockout mice for a number of years, and what we find is that KCNE2 directly regulates potassium channels in cardiac myocytes, which are the cells that are responsible for muscular contraction of the heart, and that can go a long way to explaining why the KCNE2 knockout mice have long QT syndrome. However, we've also studied for a number of years that KCNE2 is very important in a lot of polarized epithelial cells. And defects in those tissues caused by knocking out KCNE2 can indirectly affect the heart and exacerbate the cardiac arrhythmia. Moving on to the brain, we think something similar is happening there. We think that KCNE2 probably is expressed in some neurons. It's very difficult to detect. It's a very small protein that likes to hang around with much larger proteins that probably cover up epitope sites. And we think, based on the work of others, that it probably is expressed in some neuronal populations. However, it's also expressed in this fascinating tissue, the choroid plexus epithelium, and that's a polarized, non-excitable epithelial tissue, and we think that this is also affecting some of the brain functions. And whether it directly affects seizure activity or not, we don't know yet, and that's where this new study comes in.
The choroid plexus cells are the cells that make cerebrospinal fluid?
Yes. So once we started seeing handling-induced seizures in KCNE2 knockout mice, we started to think, okay, this protein is important in the brain. And we looked online at atlases where people had looked at expression of lots of different genes, and the thing that stood out about KCNE2 was that the place in the body where it was most highly expressed is in the choroid plexus epithelium. And this is the primary site of cerebrospinal fluid production and secretion. So we really got excited about studying the choroid plexus epithelium. The unusual thing about KCNE2 is that it can hold open voltage-gated potassium channels, and this is the key to your question about why KCNE2 is important in both excitable and non-excitable cells. What KCNE2 can do, it can lock open the voltage sensor of voltage-gated potassium channels, so the channel is now constitutively active. It's open and functioning at all membrane potentials, and that unlocks the potential of KCNE2, KCNQ1 channels to perform these amazing roles in all these polarized epithelia. So when we found that KCNE2 was expressed in choroid plexus, we followed up and used antibodies to confirm that KCNE2 protein was there, And then we found that KCNE2 regulates two different potassium channels in the choroplexus epithelium. We also found that KCNE2 knockout mice are more susceptible to chemoconvulsant-induced seizures than the wild-type mice. So we naturally made the connection that there may be something wrong with the cerebrospinal fluid that can increase seizure susceptibility.
Specifically, what's wrong with the cerebrospinal fluid in KCNE2 knockouts?
We started a bit of a detective work to figure out what's wrong with the CSF. And we looked for differences in potassium, because of the potassium channel, and there were none. And we looked at pH, and we also looked at a number of other ions, and nothing was different. So then we went to this unbiased kind of global metabolomics approach. And this uses sophisticated mass spectrometry shotgun techniques to basically look at all the metabolites in the CSF to see what's different. And when we did that with the collaborators in New York, we found that there was only one recognizable metabolite that was significantly different between wild-type and KCNE2 knockout mice. And that was the cyclic polyol called myo-inositol.
What is myo-inositol, and why is its presence in cerebrospinal fluid important?
Myo-inositol is a cyclic polyol. It's a carbohydrate, but it's not actually a classic sugar. So if you imagine it being about half as sweet as normal table sugar. And the reason it's important really can be split into two areas. It's an important osmolite in the body, so it's important for regulation of cell volume and fluid homeostasis. But also it's very important in that it's a structural component of lipids, such as phosphatidyl inositol and phosphates, and also the phosphatidyl inositol phosphate, or PIP, lipids. And the reason those are important, they are essential for many different signaling processes, especially with membrane-bound proteins. So inositol basically performs this very complex role in cell signaling by acting as a precursor or an important component of all these different lipids and their phosphates. Now, why is myo-inositol important in the cerebrospinal fluid? Well, that's a very difficult one, and that one took us a long time to figure out, and we're still not 100% there yet. Myo-inositol is known to be essential for normal functioning of neurons and electrical activity of neurons. And for it to get from the blood to the neurons, one of the main pathways is through the choroplexus and via the CSF. So the CSF, or cerebrospinal fluid, bathes the neurons. It's important, obviously, for physical protection of the brain, but it's also important to provide oxygen and other nutrients. And myo-inositol is one of the things that passes from the blood through the choroplexus into the CSF and on into neurons.
How does having less myo-inositol in the cerebrospinal fluid trigger seizures?
This is a question that's been going on for decades, and we think we're getting closer to the answer, but we're not 100% there yet. We definitely see lower myo-inositol in the cerebrospinal fluid of the KCNE2 knockouts. We also see that the KCNE2 knockouts have higher seizure susceptibility than the wild types. And furthermore, we see that when you megadose the mice with huge quantities of myo-inositol, you actually normalize the seizure susceptibility so it looks like that of wild type. Logically, it makes you think, okay, they've got a myo-inositol deficiency. We give them back large quantities of myo-inositol and it goes away. So we're basically treating the myo-inositol deficiency in the CSF. But it's not actually as simple as that. What we think is that the CSF myo-inositol deficiency is really a biomarker for something that's going on in the neurons that we don't yet understand. So there's something about having not enough myo-inositol getting to the brain. Perhaps it could be something to do with electrical excitability. That's not 100% known yet. And what we're seeing in the CSF is really just a hint that there's something going wrong with myo-inositol signaling in the brain. So really, it was the crucial finding with this metabolomic search to find that myo-inositol was the one thing that was different between the wild-type and knockout CSF, but it doesn't 100% mechanistically explain why the KCNE2 knockout mice have higher seizure susceptibility. What it's telling us is that there's some kind of defect in the brain between this new type of complex we have found, which involves the potassium channel and the myo-inositol transporter. And that's really where we are right now.
mechanistically, how does KCNE2 affect the abundance of myo-inositol in cerebrospinal fluid? You mentioned a complex?
Yes. So previously we found that KCNE2 and KCNQ1, so KCNE2 is a regulatory subunit and KCNQ1 is what we call the pore-forming or alpha subunit of the potassium channel. These two form a heteromeric potassium channel complex at the apical membrane of the choroid plexus. So that's the side of the membrane that faces the CSF. So moving on to our newest discovery, we find that also in this complex is this sodium-dependent myo-inositol transporter called SMIT1. So SMIT1 is expressed, as we show in this paper, at the basolateral side, which is the blood side of the choroid plexus, and is almost certainly the transporter responsible for bringing myo-inositol from the blood into the choroid plexus. Now, what we think currently is that there's an unknown pathway for bringing myo-inositol from the choroid plexus across the apical membrane into the CSF. Our model is that the SMIT1, KCNQ1, KCNE2 complex is actually there to bring back or regulate myo-inositol so it doesn't get too high in the CSF. That's our current thinking. So that what it does, it requires a sodium gradient downhill from the CSF to the choroid plexus to bring back myo-inositol from the CSF to the choroid plexus to make sure it doesn't get too high or perhaps for other regulatory reasons. When we knock out KCNE2, paradoxically, the activity of that transporter complex goes up. And that's our current thinking, is that now we're bringing too much myo-inositol out of the CSF and into the choroid plexus epithelium. And that explains why we have lower myo-inositol in the CSF of the knockouts compared to the wild-type animals. So coming out of the mouse and going into a simple cell system so we can study things at the mechanistic level, when we co-express the potassium channel KCNQ1 with the sodium-dependent myo-inositol transporter SMIT1, we find that the channel doubles the transporter activity, so twice as much inositol is getting into the cell, and the transporter doubles the channel activity, so twice as much potassium is going out through the channel. So they augment one another's function. Now, when you bring KCNE2 into the complex, which is what's occurring in normal mice, there's actually a suppression of the transporter activity. So the outward currents reduce, but they have this ability to open at negative potentials. And overall, they inhibit the transporter activity. So what we think is happening in the mice, when we delete KCNE2, we are now going back to the situation we see in the cells where we just have KCNQ1 with SMIT1, and they both have very high activity in that context. So that's why we think knocking out KCNE2 makes this channel transporter complex bring too much myo-inositol back out of the CSF and into the choroid plexus.
What is the logic behind coupling potassium transport to myo-inositol transport? Does potassium and myo-inositol need to be co-regulated, or is the system just taking advantage of the potassium gradient that's already there?
That's an excellent question. And as usual with these questions, we know some of the answers, and you know, we've created more questions by finding this complex. The obvious hypothesis is that this channel, it kicks out more potassium from the cell when the cell membrane is depolarized. So the more positive it gets inside the cell, the more potassium is likely to leave the cell, diffuse down the electrochemical gradient. So if you can imagine, you have a potassium channel co-assembled with a sodium-dependent transporter. As the sodium comes in down its concentration gradient and brings the myo-inositol with it, that has a depolarizing effect because the sodium is positively charged. That would open up the potassium channel more or allow more potassium to diffuse out of the cell. So the simple hypothesis is that the potassium channel is right there with the transporter to provide a very quick way of increasing the gradient to make it more favorable for sodium and thus myo-inositol to come into the cell. However, there were a couple of observations we made that suggest that it's not quite as simple as that. So we made a mutation in the voltage sensor of the potassium channel that now holds the channel open and makes the currents really big at all voltages. Paradoxically, that inhibited strongly the transporter function. So we don't necessarily think the driving force effect is wrong, but we think that there's something more complicated going on. We think that there's some kind of intimate crosstalk between the channel machinery, if you like, and the transporter. So we think they're very tightly associated. So it's not just the channel creating a driving force for the transporter. We think there's much more intimate association than that. Why would you need these things to come together? Well, KCNQ1 is a fascinating potassium channel. It's involved in cell volume regulation. It's highly regulated by those phosphatidylinositol phosphate lipids, those PIPs I was talking about earlier. It's sensitive to pH and to a number of other different proteins that can regulate its function. So if you can imagine, you've got a myonositol transporter that brings in myonositol, which is an important component of all these structural lipids and phosphatidylinositol phosphate lipids, and then you've got a channel that's regulated by those same lipids. So you've got a crosstalk whereby, for instance, you might be able to regulate how much myonositol comes into the cell based on the channel telling you there's too much or too little. That's one hypothesis. The other thing is, obviously, KCNQ1 can be regulated not just by these KCNE genes that like KCNE2, but can be regulated by things like calmodulin and lots of other proteins. So it sets up this signaling hub in the cell membrane, which can respond to all these different inputs, to electrochemical driving force, to pH, to cell volume, and now it links the channel intimately with the transporter, and vice versa, the myonositol transporter has all these regulatory pathways as well that can tell the channel what to do. So that's why we think they come together. There may be a strong driving force effect, but we think they're acting as this now, this very complicated signaling hub to allow crosstalk between the electrical gradient, the chemical gradient, the lipid concentration or lipid precursor concentration, and the inositol transporter.
In the KCNE2 knockout mouse, the only metabolite that you found that was abnormal in cerebrospinal fluid was myo-inositol. Is this paradigm that you've described potentially acting in other tissues with other transporters to couple small molecule transport to ion channel activity?
That's a great question, and it speaks to the generality of this new paradigm. We think absolutely that's happening. So in the current manuscript, we show that SGLT1, which is a sodium-dependent sugar transporter, is also affected by KCNQ1. We also show that the other myonositol transporter, SMIT2, has opposite effects, actually, on KCNQ1 than SMIT1 does. We had a paper a few years ago showing that thyroid hormone synthesis is affected by KCNE2 knockout. And in fact, iodide uptake into thyroid cells is impaired when you knock out KCNE2. We also found that KCNQ1, KCNE2 channels form in the basolateral membrane of thyroid cells. Now, why I'm telling you that is because the transporter that is responsible for uptake of iodide into thyroid cells is on the basolateral membrane. It's a sodium-dependent iodide symporter in the same gene family as the myonositol transporter. So we are currently looking in to whether there's more intimate links between those proteins. We know they're codependent, and we're now looking further. Now, the other interesting finding, which is relevant to this, is that KCNQ1 is strongly linked to human diabetes. And we recently published another paper showing that KCNE2 knockout mice get diabetes. So we're currently very excited about looking at the possible interactions between KCNQ1, KCNE2, and a number of different sugar transporters.
Dr. Abbott, thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, Annalisa.
That was Jeffrey Abbott discussing a paper by Abbott and colleagues published in the March 4th issue of Science Signaling. You can read that article online at stke.sciencemag.org. The Science Signaling Podcast is a production of Science Signaling and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, serving society. If you have any comments or questions, you can write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and AAAS, thanks for listening.